This podcast is brought to you with support from The Big Idea, New Zealand's online hub for creative people. The Big Idea aims to support talented, innovative individuals and organisations and advocates for creativity as an essential ingredient in the cultural and economic wealth of New Zealand. Their website is thebigidea.nz. This episode is also brought to you by We Are Braves, a photography company that creates artistic, beautiful images that will boost your self-esteem and celebrate the real you. We Are Braves offers portrait, boudoir and body art packages, and the team will work closely with you to bring your vision to life. A great idea for a gift for your loved ones or simply a gift for yourself. Visit wearebraves.co.nz to find out more. And while you're listening to this episode, check out Chris Campbell Custom Shop. Chris Campbell's extensive experience in the music world allows him to produce guitars, effects and amplifiers that are simply right from the first moment you play them. The website is chriscampbellcustomshop.com. And last but not least, Rockbox Electronics produce some of the finest guitar pedals we've come across. My favourite is the Baby Blues. Rockbox Electronics are committed to creating the greatest sounds in rock using the best of vintage and modern technologies. Check them out at rockbox.com. Welcome to Don't Give Up Your Day Job, the podcast, the only podcast you need. I'm feeling pretty tired right now. How are you feeling?
How come?
Well, I've just been on this huge run of stuff. You know, it's just been endless. I don't think I've had a day or a night off for months.
You've recently been in Australia, haven't you?
Yeah. We've just finished this tour called the Let It Rain Tour, which is a fundraising thing for some of the farmers that are facing drought in Australia. So a group, a promoter over there arranged three bands to tour together. So we're over there in Melbourne, and we spent a bit more time there doing some promo spots and radio things and whatever. And that was cool. It's just that I've got all the stuff before that was going on, and you know, come back to a very full schedule, and
yeah.
I still don't even know what happened. But we did the last show of the tour last night, and it was a huge amount of fun. Lots of great people, you know, in the team, and had a blast, but just I now need to go and sleep for 6 months.
And the album as well, on top of all of that?
Yes, I've announced a release date for the first single / music video. The video's, the song, I mean, is called Hustle Bustle, which is the title track. We shot the video, some of it here and some of it in LA, and so it's all being put together as we speak. So that's yet another one of my many projects that's going on all
Good
at the same time.
God, man. Do you ever sleep?
No, but I figure I'll at some point I'll get a chance. Maybe that's what my retirement will be, is catching up on sleep.
Sleeping. Okay, we've still got a wee whiles to go, yeah.
That's right. And last night we're up until 4 a.m. because we did the last show of the tour, and Lisa Crawley, who's obviously a well-known and respected individual in our scene here, she was in the show we did last night, and so we went out afterwards, and she's just actually secured a starring role in the upcoming stage production of Once. Remember the movie Once?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so they're about to, about to take that to the stage.
Okay, is that going to be in Auckland?
Yep,
or?
Yep. I believe it's maybe Aotea or Civic, one of those places.
God, I hope it's better than that $8 million flop that was at the Sky City.
Oh, I don't know what you mean. What's that about?
There was some show that was funded by, there's some shady shit going on in the background. They don't really know who was funding it, but they spent $8 million on a show in I think it's something like 800-seater theatre, and there were 70 people a night coming, and most of those were comps, but it was a full, there were more people on stage than were in the audience,
wow.
And it was a full musical, full set, and they just dragged it on for months and months and months.
Oh my God, who was the brainchild behind that? What a mess.
I don't remember the guy's name, but yeah, he's got money, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a pretty great role for Lisa to get.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, after the show we did last night, we went to a bar where some of the cast were hanging out from Once. They're going to start rehearsals tomorrow from the date of this recording. And after the bar, we decided to come back to my place for a jam. So I'm sitting there actually getting the first ever, because they'd never actually sung the main song together before, because rehearsals start tomorrow, right?
Right.
So they're now, it's like 3 a.m, wine and instruments everywhere in my lounge, and they're like, should we try the song? And they're doing it, and I'm super tired and, you know, kind of barely there And I'm thinking, this is kind of a cool moment.
So, yeah, man.
But it was late, and then I slept in, and then I didn't get as much done today as I wanted to.
But you're getting this done, which is, you can tick this off the to-do list.
This is the main thing. And so, yeah, we're over in Melbourne, and we're doing this radio spot, and partway through the interview, they say, Michael's coming in. And I'm like, I don't know who that is, but it's okay. So this guy walks in, and he turns out to be a really funny guy and very personable. And I still haven't quite clicked who he is, but then I start to put together that he's the one of the other bands. He's the songwriter, singer from one of the other bands, one of the other artists that we're touring with. I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. All right. And so we do this thing. The radio interview's a little bit weird because the host of the show just doesn't ask any questions. But then she starts criticizing us on air about us not saying anything. So she goes to ad break, turns the red light off, and so we start chatting, and we've now introduced ourselves to each other and we're talking about things or whatever, having a laugh. Then she, we hear the music coming fading down, she puts the red light on, and because we're all pretty experienced at this, we see the red light go on, and we all stop talking. And then she goes on mic, live on the air, she goes, "Oh, you guys stop talking." And we're like, "What?" And then she'd ask like yes or no questions, and it's like blah blah blah, right. And it's like, yep.
Was that her first interview?
She had appeared to have been there for quite some time. And but eventually on air she keeps going, "You guys don't say anything, you're not talking." And at one point our singer's girlfriend was there taking photos, and she goes, "Perhaps if you thought about, I don't know, asking better questions."
Oh, burn.
So it was pretty funny, and so that gave us all something to laugh about, and we all went for a coffee after that.
I presume, except for the presenter.
Yeah, I don't know if she knew which way was up. It was a very, very right. strange interview. But
sounds it.
But we went on this tour, and I got to know Michael really well, and it turns out that he's a phenomenal singer-songwriter with a great voice, and he really has it. You know, some people just have it when it comes to writing and performing. And then I find out that he's actually a very successful jingle writer. And so maybe 10 to 15 years ago, he set up a company where he writes jingles for commercials, and went out there and tried to sell them, and it worked. Major sure. commercials all over the country are being played with his music on it.
Excellent.
And on top of that, he's still writing songs and putting it out, and he had a chance to work with Neil Finn at one point. He came over here and worked with Neil Finn at Roundhead. And he had a song chart in the States. And so all these really interesting stories came about, and I thought, this is exactly what the podcast is about, is someone who started off just wanting to be a singer-songwriter like everybody else, and has figured out how to make a career out of music. And maybe a way that he couldn't have anticipated, and it was outside the rock and roll dream. And in the meantime, he's had to wrestle with that. Is this failure or is this success? he thought he was going to be Bob Dylan, but he turned out to be a guy who wrote radio jingles. Is that failure or success? And he's got kids and a wife and a life that he's put together through music.
Yeah.
I think that's a success, personally.
Sounds very successful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a perfect candidate for the show. And he came over to New Zealand. We did the New Zealand shows here. And I said to him, while we're here, why don't we do a show? And he said, yep, absolutely.
Right.
So here we are.
Is this your way of telling me that he's the guest today?
Yes, he is the guest today.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay. You wove them in there, and I didn't pick up on that, so that's my bad.
Well, I realised that we often forget to mention who the guest is until the very last minute.
I still don't think you've said his full name. Michael
Burrows.
Oh, Michael Burrows.
Yeah. Okay. We also did something else that we have not done before, which is really cool. At the end of the episode, we actually recorded him performing one of his new songs with his guitar player playing lap steel. And so there's a really special moment there. And it went so well, I think we might keep doing that with certain guests.
That's a good call.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's a really nice touch. So I'm quite excited about that. We also filmed it, and we'll have that available on YouTube and our Facebook page and so on as this episode comes out. So go and check that out.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to it.
Cool. Enjoy.
Now let's do this. We're in an inspiring room.
Is it inspiring?
With good people, yeah.
Are you feeling the muse? Come on.
Well, I feel very comfortable surrounded by instruments.
Yes.
I feel like, because if things are set up, you just never know when things are, what can happen.
Right. So like, just having, like your studio.
Yeah.
Is it always ready to go like that?
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I remember reading something about either Roundhead Studios or Wilco's The Loft, where they really vibe on everything set up so that if the moment takes you,
yeah,
you can just jump into it and go.
Right. Yeah.
I kind of love that idea, and I don't use it often enough.
Yeah, we had a great time there in Melbourne. So you're from Melbourne?
Yeah.
For the sake of people listening. And it was great. I mean, just turned up one night randomly and all started playing.
Just as long as we're in the same key, it kind of works.
Yeah, well, we stayed on one chord for a good 13 minutes.
And the next stage, I guess, would be to be able to record it.
Right.
You know, which I haven't really... Just
you must have the facilities.
We've got the facilities in the other room. But yeah, that's the dream kind of scenario, really.
Yeah.
As a creative.
What's stopping you?
Time and, you know, just that
cables?
I get lost cables.
Buy some more cables.
I need some more patching leads.
Yep.
Actually, it would be amazing having your pedals always set up.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like you don't get enough pedal time experimenting.
Well, I've always got too many pedals to fit on my board, so I just have the pedals that aren't on my board, you know, permanently set up in the room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. It's really good.
It's my practice pedals.
Now, you've got it all happening here. You've got amps and
got a lot packed
great
into pitches.
Place,
yeah.
But it just means you can pick up something and run with whatever feeling you have.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, and I find like in our world of having to do things commercially, it just you have to be spontaneous because some deadlines are instant.
But also the distance between getting the idea and getting the idea down, you don't want to fuck around too much, right? In that space.
No.
You don't want to lose an hour trying to get shit to work, right?
Well, yeah, that's right. You sort of have to, you have to have a gut feeling and you have to just honor that and go with it. Otherwise, you're totally, you know, and especially when the pressure's on, I think that's when we come alive.
Right.
When someone really says this has to, we're presenting it tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And I've just briefed you at 10 a.m. the previous day. That's when my juices are flowing. When something's like a week away or don't stress, well, you know, there's no rush, no one's going to make a decision. That's when I start to panic and get lost sometimes in overthinking it.
But I agree with you. I think deadlines are really good for art, you know, and I we were talking about this on the drive down that we just did with home studios and how a lot of people now have home studios and never quite get around to recording things. You know, you finally got all the stuff where you can make an album like, you know, every other week, but you just don't get around to it.
I totally agree. Yeah. And I think that also happens with having so many virtual tracks. I mean, you think about the greatest albums that we all love.
Yeah.
They were probably done on such minimal that they just couldn't, they had to bounce things and,
you know. Had to make decisions.
And so, so it's very luxurious to have so many opportunities and it's kind of nice to limit yourself.
I think so. And if you are paying money to go into a big studio and that sort of thing, even though that's getting less and less relevant as time goes on.
Yeah.
But, you know, you do have the deadline because the money's going to run out, you know, and
absolutely.
The studio's booking is going to run out, you know. So you've got to get it done and make decisions fast and the ideas have to be strong enough to commit to.
I've actually never recorded my own music in the studio because it feels like I'm in there day to day working on all the commercial stuff.
You mean in your own studio?
Yeah, in my own studio that I just haven't yet. And I feel like there's something coming that I feel like I'm going to really give it a go. I feel really comfortable.
Well, it's a great space. I mean, it's got the whole vibe going for it.
Yeah, that's for sure. I really, really love coming in every day. But I get so lost in the business side of things, you know, trying to run it and make it happen that I'm a hoarder from way back.
Right, yeah.
So every bit of instrument that, you know, my wife says, that would probably, I know when she wants it to go, when it's sort of like, that you know, that would suit the studio. Weird picture, all of that.
It's a way of getting it out of the house.
Yeah, but it's also a good place to purchase things without being caught.
Right. You
know? So okay. There's a few more guitars, and maybe we had budgeted for or can need.
And that's when you go, no, I always had that guitar.
I always had that.
It's been there the whole time. What's wrong with you?
You know. So it's kind of nice to stash things away. But
was it always a dream of you to have a space like that, a creative space? Like, could you imagine that kind of thing from the early days?
I'm not just saying it because I'm in New Zealand, but getting to record with Neil Finn in his studio and seeing how he lived upstairs, there were bands just coming in.
Yeah.
That's the dream scenario.
Yeah.
I was totally jealous of that setup.
Mm.
You know, not only it's a beautiful building, but just that idea that I'd love to have that. And I've talked about that with my wife. Just if we found a place and maybe when the kids are a bit older, you know, you could live above it.
Yeah.
You could have a working studio,
yeah,
and just interesting creative projects constantly in there. It just that would keep you really alive. And,
yeah, we've talked about the same thing, having a multi-purpose space.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
It's kind of heaven. Like rehearse in your own space, record in your own space. So, how did the Neil Finn thing come around?
Well, that was I had kind of run away from doing my own music for quite a while,
yeah,
and I had set up Brand Music as a commercial entity, and I think there's a. I'm not a religious person or a spiritual person at all, but I think there's a real force that runs alongside us all. And when you're ready to tap into it, it's kind of there.
Right.
And that was a moment I was approaching 40.
Yeah.
And my wife said, I'm sick of hearing about all these excuses about not doing your own music.
Right.
And
good wife.
Yeah, good wife. And she booked a show for me. She booked all these people and I played. I wrote a whole set of new songs.
Yeah.
A bass player from my old band told me that there was this opportunity through Medicine Mondiale, which is a New Zealand-based charity that Neil Finn's part of.
Mm-hmm.
They had this amazing thing happening where you could record with Neil for 2 days and, you know, so I sent demos and did all these things.
Like
and
competition?
Yeah, it was like a competition and a charity kind of thing, an auction kind of thing well.
Yeah.
I put myself forward. I put the demos forward and I was standing on this remote beach just thinking, I've got it. This has to be mine. Like, this is the ultimate. This would be just, that's it, really, for me. I knew it had to be.
Because
had
you're
to.
A big Finn Brothers fan, are you?
Man, yeah, you know,
Split Ends, Crowded House,
I sang thing. 6 months in a Leaky Boat to my grade 4.
Really?
So 8-year-old, I was singing air guitar in front of my class.
Yeah.
You know, so his voice and Split Ends and, you know, they've been part of my palette to dip into,
right?
You know, sonic palette for sure.
Yeah,
there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got it, and next thing you know, you're getting an email from your hero saying, "Great, can't wait. I love these two songs. Going to record them.
Yeah.
Here's the date. You know, and it's just
so
crazy.
So you were nervous?
Yeah, I really was, and I said some silly things. I think when I entered there, I made some comment about the weather and tried to bring it tied into, you know, four seasons in one day, and then I realized, you know, we're here to work, and we did. We just got on with it.
Yep.
Like the most generous guy I've really, I went there with just the expectation maybe I'd play some songs and we'd talk about it.
Right.
But we ended up recording. He, you know, he sat with us for every meal. He talked to me about some of the lyrics. And then when he said, you know, can I jump in the vocal booth and put harmonies down, I was ready to die right there in
that's all you need.
On Newtown Road.
So what kind of feedback did he give you about lyrics?
Yeah, well, I think he didn't want to overstep his mark because it wasn't really – the pressure wasn't on him necessarily to produce it.
Mm.
But he ended up kind of producing the rhythm track. And I guess just as an artist, just being able to talk to me about, you know, what I was trying to achieve. And
right.
I can see some of the lyrics. I did take it on. You know, I couldn't believe he was standing next to me just saying, maybe that word could be that. And I'm
– right.
You know, I think that's a hard thing for a producer, to not overstep.
No, but I'm just because he's such a great songwriter, I'd be curious to know what sort of things he picked up on. Was he correcting?
Yeah, I guess I'm always caught between, you know, Neil Finn in one side of my head and Paul Kelly on the other side, where Neil Finn can kind of get lost in the abstract sometimes.
Yeah.
It all makes sense somehow.
Yeah.
And Paul Kelly's very directive and very, he just says he's feeling. If he's sad, I'm sad. And
right.
And you still get the same depth
yeah.
of character and emotion from both.
Mm. That's an interesting way of putting it. Because you're right, Neil Finn's always been more poetic, isn't he?
Yeah, really poetic. And you just feel that when he's talking about colours or emotion, and obviously he's so well-read, I think both of them are,
yeah.
that their vernacular and, you know, the use of words is so succinct that it comes through and you can just, it paints a picture.
Yeah, I never thought about it like that before because Neil is more of a storyteller, isn't he? I mean, he's, one of my favourite Neil Finn songs is a song called Nails in My Feet.
Oh, yeah.
And I have no idea listening to it whether he's writing about himself or someone else, you know, but there's he draws you into the story and you're now lost in this character.
And you've got all this imagery.
Yeah.
Of sand and...
That's right.
You know, and I don't know what that's really about.
Well, the story of Nails in My Feet, I kind of almost feel like I remember it being me.
Yeah.
Because it's so powerful, it sort of embedded itself as a memory.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
And there was sort of a soothing moment in there, isn't there? There's a line about your touch is so soothing or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And I love the line, I woke up, the house stumbled in sideways, you know.
Amazing.
The lights went on, everyone screamed surprise.
I think I tried to copy that line.
I just feel it's so moving that this character is in such a dark headspace and you imagine him being drunk and angry and whatever.
Yeah. And then
coming in and like, hooray, good little surprise.
Last thing you want.
Yeah, exactly.
Last thing you want.
Last thing you want, but at the same time you're turned around by the kindness of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of had a religious feel. I sense there's a lot of religion playing in a lot of his writing. Not necessarily being a religious person, but just maybe stuff that you can draw on from the Bible or from verses and things that comes through.
Maybe that comes from his childhood.
Possibly.
Did he go to a Catholic school or something?
I believe so. Yeah. I believe so, I imagine.
Or maybe his parents were Catholic. I feel like I should know that, but I can't remember.
You should know that. I thought that's
being
what
a self-respecting
you guys
Kiwi.
Wouldn't you get taught that in,
in school?
You know, the Hakka and also Finn.
The Finn class.
Finn class, yeah. Because, I definitely would put that on the curriculum.
Yeah, I think I agree. Yeah,
I think next election.
Yeah. So you've never released a song you did with him?
No, I didn't. I'd
be putting it out straight away. I'd have put it out the day before.
I really wanted to. I was really blown away by it. I've got these great excerpts where he's just, you know, obviously I've got all the separated tracks and I go back sometimes and just to check that it was real.
Right. Just to check it happened.
Of him singing, you know, the songs. What happened is, I kind of put them out on Bandcamp.
Yeah.
And they are there. You can look up Neil Finn on Bandcamp and you'll hear them. Right. And they sit there.
What's the name of the song?
Please Don't Cry.
Yep.
And Hinges was the original version. And what happened is from there I kind of got to – this is what I mean by this spiritual thing that happened is that I suddenly went out after I finished that thing, the Neil Finn experience, suddenly I was chosen to go on tour with Martha Wainwright, who's Americana kind of folk
Fantastic.
Artist.
Yeah.
So I was opening for her and then I posted a video on YouTube. And Duncan, who's sitting here patiently next to me, who's the guitarist in Great Love, he had met this guy on a cruise ship 7 years ago or previous, maybe even longer.
Yeah.
I don't know. He was playing in cruise ships. And somehow, because of the algorithms of Facebook, this guy in Washington, Larry, who knew Duncan, who they'd met on a cruise ship, and they probably had only met for a couple of days,
right.
Suddenly said, well, what is this video? I really like this song. What this sound is, you guys should come and do something. And Duncan was like, we were having, it was just hard to play as a band at that time.
Yeah.
And everyone was
internal issues and things. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. No, just in terms of projects and it's just so.
Oh, I see. Busy. And
my attitude towards having to run a band and organize gigs and things, it's just really hard.
Yeah.
Duncan was playing in a few different outfits. And so he kind of linked us in via email.
Yeah.
And Larry became a really big, important part of the next step.
Right.
Talk about, he's like, he heard the music, he heard something in it, and the next thing we know, we're in Nashville recording.
Brilliant.
And Larry has been part of it since then, and he's really been championing it and pushing it and getting amazing results for the music.
Yeah.
So I thank Duncan. He'll have his own tattoo on my left arm.
Why doesn't he already?
Yeah, that's true. I wear it on the inside. My tattoos are on the inside.
Yeah,
I haven't quite externalized them yet.
So where did it all? Where did it all start, though? Like, did you start playing really young? Or
I've always played. I grew up in a musical family,
right.
So my dad can play kind of any instrument, but not extremely well. He can just nut out any melody on any. He could just seem to always be able to pick up the harmonica and play, sing Happy Birthday or
interesting.
Yeah,
yeah. So you didn't have a definitive time that you remember when you started playing because it sort of blurred into existence. Like it was just
blurred.
Always there.
Always doing it, always playing. By the time we had an extended musical family too, so.
Right.
My cousins were all classically trained.
Oh, cool.
So we would often get together and always sing at all the festivals and, we're coming from a Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't religious, but we kind of enjoyed the music and the traditions.
Yeah.
And that brought a lot of different music that came into it. So we would always perform at family functions.
Right.
And it even got more extended that Mum would set up these real community events where she'd hire a hall and we would all play.
Yeah.
And bring in friends to sing things and we'd all end in Hunters and Collectors, Throw Your Arms Around
Me.
It would be a real communal. So we learnt to perform.
So did you have, because of that experience, did you have a lack of fear as a kid when it came to music?
No, I was very fearful of it. I was never raised as the singer. My brother was the singer. I was really the sort of the guitar player, noodler, who was good at backing vocals.
Yeah.
And Danny, my brother, and I did.
Oh, good name.
It's a good name.
Yeah.
Yeah, Danny.
Yeah.
He, he was a lot more confident and still is.
What were you afraid of, though? What was the intimidation?
I've just always been afraid of being, never felt that I was kind of not even proficient in any instrument. I just didn't feel confident. I stupidly ignored all the lessons I was given, opportunities to play guitar, to play piano. I just totally had no stamina or ability to really focus. And so I let all that go.
Right.
Yeah, I just, yeah. I really, a real shame because I can't read music.
Right.
I can't write music. I can't.
You really can't write music.
Well, I mean, writing.
That's what you do for a
notes.
Job.
Yeah. Well, I can write melodies and, yeah, you know, yeah. words and things like that. But certainly, you know, I do miss being able to pick up a songbook and just kind of going, yeah, that's how it is.
Right. Yeah.
Unless you know the song. You know, like I read a couple of years ago that Beck put out an album just on the sheet music.
Is and that right?
So it would mean that people
is
like
that
me,
right?
yeah,
I, didn't hear about that.
I think you have to look it up, but he released it as sheet music.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, that means I'm excluded.
I love that idea because there's a a songwriter from about 400 years ago called John Dowland, I think his name is. And he was like a big pop star in Europe at the time.
Right.
But he went and got his latest release and it was sheet music. Yeah. I like the idea of getting the new song comes out and you race to the piano and try and figure out how to play it.
Well, it kind of just means that that's right. So for Beck, it's genius because people who are real musicians could pick it up and play with it and people like me would just kind of have to wait and I'd have to rely on your interpretation of playing it.
Yeah. So, and then the other thing is you never know if it's quite right.
No.
I remember just a few years ago there was this thing that came out about I can't remember which one it was, one of the famous composers like Bach or something.
Yeah.
And they were saying maybe it was all we've always been playing at the wrong tempo. And I can't remember if it was too slow or too fast, but
possibly.
Yeah, someone gave an example of how it could have been.
Yeah.
You know, and it was completely different. Yeah, yeah. I mean the tempo actually is quite a big thing. Big
There's just certain periods in time where we really don't know what dinosaur skin looks like.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But we just have built a whole fantasy and myth around it and you know, it's kind of part of folklore.
Yeah, well, they're talking now that some of them might have been covered with feathers, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe Bach was played as sort of more of a Rammstein sort of...
Right, and maybe he was covered with feathers.
Classical core.
Yeah.
Classical.
Classical.
Yeah.
And so you, at a young age, did you already make the decision that you wanted to be a rock star or a professional or, you know?
Yeah, like the Beatles definitely, like all of us, had an influence. And I spent a lot of my early, you know, teens really, you know, waiting for that phone call.
Yeah. And you grew up in Melbourne?
Grew up in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Yeah. Waiting for that phone call from Paul McCartney to come and help.
Because somehow he'd hear about you, right? Because you're writing such great songs in your bedroom.
Yeah.
And he knows everything. So.
He knows everything and he was just going to call and I'd read the books and I felt it was my right.
My destiny.
Not my destiny.
My density.
My density. And
Back to the Future reference. Yeah,
got it. And he totally didn't call, which is fine. He might still. Maybe if he's listening. If you're listening, Paul, I'm still available.
No, he said he was going to call you soon.
Oh, brilliant. Okay. I just can't at the moment because I'm talking on this.
He might be calling right now.
I hope so. So I totally obsessed with that. And how can you not, you know, to suddenly, you know, be thrust with these visuals and images of people just loving your music.
You know, did you have people in your life giving you good advice that you ignored, like, you know, apply yourself and, you know, whatever, about how to get a career going?
No, because, I mean, my parents never really... It wasn't that they weren't supportive of it because they really were, you know, how could you not allow art through? But I think it's just a really hard thing to watch your children go through that, I imagine, now as a dad, just thinking, wow, that, you know, I hope I'm going to be that kind of dad who's like,
yeah,
let's support you and we're going to get you a thing and do that thing and you're going to go on there and go for it, man.
We've talked about that a few times on the show because, you know, I've been a full-time musician for a long time, but I don't know if I'd want my future kids to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's a hard road.
It's a hard road.
Yeah. At the same time, I don't want to ever inhibit them. So
That's a really hard thing. And so mum and dad were very supportive of it and still are really proud of all the music that I get to do.
Mm.
You know, and they hear a lot of my stuff on radio and are really proud of that.
Yeah.
But inside, I guess I wish that I'd believed in myself a lot more in my 20s, definitely, when I was playing in bands and still writing. Mm. And I took a lot for granted and I kind of got scared by it all and ran away, essentially, till sort of my mid-30s.
And so in your 20s, you bounced around different rock bands and stuff and did the whole sort of the usual deal.
Yep, it was great.
Were there high points in there?
Yeah, real high points. Yep. Some radio play on the national station. Playing lots of great shows, great band. And if I listen back to the songs, it was still stuff that I'm writing today. It really was. I just didn't have the confidence in it and felt like people were sort of starting to feel sorry for you.
Yeah,
that, are you really still trying? And if you hadn't made it by then, what's the point?
Isn't that I experienced that same feeling. But isn't that a shame to feel that? Because you don't make music for that reason. You make music because music is its own reward, right?
If I'm being really honest with you, I have to evolve to that point.
Yeah.
I don't think I've evolved to it yet. I feel like I'm still caught up in that if it's not, you're not playing shows to thousands and you're not doing that, then you, really, obviously maybe your music isn't any good. I know it sounds really horrible and harsh.
No, but I think that's also a reflection of culture, you know, because we're all trying to somehow find a way of being relevant. You know, yeah. The way that we present ourselves on social media, for example, is never true. It's never the full story.
No, that's right. That's for sure. Yeah.
Know? But we're all trying to somehow come across as more important and more exciting than we really are. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah. And yeah. I kind of... If I really search myself, and I sound like a prat saying it, but all the validation that happened from Neil Finn all the way through to in this recent bout of regenerating what I want to do as an artist, I feel having a little bit of age on it means that I am really starting to enjoy the music. Right. And I think attracting great people around me, you know, like Duncan and great people who are great players, I don't think they'd waste their time if it, you know, you have to, are inner voices you have that if people are really wanting to surround themselves and be part of it, then. You know, because the paycheck certainly isn't massive. So there must be something in the songs.
Also, what I've noticed, though, is that the naysayers are often the people that don't do anything. You know, it's really easy to criticize people and not put your own self at risk, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the curse of the Beatles, too. I think what happened is you get locked into watching this stuff when they're sort of 16, 17-year-olds and the whole mythology of it.
Yeah.
And you kind of feel, well, then if 20 it hasn't happened, then stuff it. Fuck it. It's not me. It's not my destiny. And that's a real shame because I don't think now more than ever when artists can kind of take control of their own art and they're not just sort of left to the labels to help dictate when things are released and pushed out, we've got a real chance to just connect with people.
I think it's a common mistake that people make is trying to pick up what's happened in the past and then apply it to the future. You know, like I think that people do it in business as well. They go, look what Steve Jobs did. And they try to copy what Steve Jobs did now.
Yeah.
But what he did was relevant at
his time. That's exactly right. And I think the more I go through life, I'm realizing that a lot has to do with luck and timing, as it should, really.
And proactivity, putting yourself out there.
And proactivity. But largely just the universe has got its own way of working. And the same way that happened with Larry via Duncan. If I hadn't met Duncan, I wouldn't have met Larry. If I met, you know, and I wouldn't have got to Nashville and record the thing. You know, so I think everything's... connected when it's meant to connect.
Right. Yeah.
And sometimes you're not aware of when those hands are being reached out.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of negative voices in my head.
Yeah.
You know, I always have.
Yeah.
And it's easy to listen to those and get sucked into them. And they take me to places that are just really hard to get out of sometimes. Absolutely.
So what was the thing at the end of your 20s or whenever you sort of you stepped away from music? Was there a thing that happened, a moment, an event that pushed you out, or was it sort of you faded away from it?
Well, earlier than my 20s, when I was about 15, 16, my best friend at school, Daniel, he taught me my first chord sort of on guitar around 13, 14.
Yeah.
And we got to go and he said to me, look, twist and shout. We learned twist and shout, so I could kind of do it with bar chords and that was it from an E bar chord. And he said, look, the school dance is coming up. Do you want to play that song? I'd never played live, never played anything.
Yeah.
You know, red Stratocaster. Plugged in, the girl I took to the dance, you know, I just kind of said, look, I'm going to play this song. You know, it's a real Back to the Future moment kind of playing.
Did you jump down on your knees?
No. No, you guys aren't ready for this. Maybe you guys aren't ready for this. I played it and something just went boom. I just watched these people going off and I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is like coming out of me and the guitar and this is everything I've ever wanted, you know? And they turned my amp off for the rest of the show and I mimed the whole rest of the thing because I only knew one chord, so I couldn't play the song. The girl kissed another guy.
Oh, what
totally
the fuck?
Fine. Yeah, whatever.
But you played the guitar.
Didn't matter.
That should be a shoo-in.
No, man, it wasn't. She, I think she married him, so I'm happy for you.
Oh, fuck them.
You know, I've been to, you know. I was kind of happy because I felt like a real asshole just kind of, you know.
I just still love the way you opened the show last night. Has anyone here had their heart broken? Yeah. Well, fuck them.
Yeah, that's right. That's how I was feeling.
Yeah. First thing you said.
Maybe she was part of it. You know, maybe you never let go of these things. Maybe it's like a high fidelity constantly where you're going back and needing to speak to ex-girlfriends to kind of solve your future. So I, that was a light bulb moment of like, man, you can move people and they really, afterwards they were patting you on the hat, you know, on the head and just like you, it just felt good, you know, for your ego. Never the same since. So that was the biggest show I've
done. That's the high point.
And I just think from there, you know, playing in around campfires, if you've got a guitar, you can kind of lead people and connect people. And I found that it was a great vehicle for just being able to write feelings down and connect them to rhythms and things like that. And then you've got this soundtrack that you've grown up with from Crowded House to, you know, U2 and Beatles, and
they just going to say from Crowded House or Split Ends to Split the Finn Ends, Brothers,
the Finn Brothers, and that was it. That was my that was it.
Yeah,
Schnell Fenster, and you know, that's you've got it all.
Yeah,
so that led to, you know, high school and playing, and then I sort of got the guts to start a band.
Yeah,
and it was still hard then as it is now, I think. Just personalities of people. You're dealing with four people. It's like being married to four or five people.
Big characters too, right?
Everyone's
in our
got,
industry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And playing with people who really are talented, you know. I really believe in surrounding yourself with amazing people because still having the insecurities of my own playing means that at least it's kind of covered to some degree. My amp isn't turned off as much these days, but it probably should. I mean, don't see why not.
But we were getting to what caused you to step away. Like what was the thing that burnt you out?
After the demise of the last band we had called One Stop View, I just kind of found it really, I had a girlfriend who sort of said, well, how are you going to, you know, the relationship didn't last, but what was really good about it is that she kind of just sort of had this business head on her, and she was like, you know, come on, you just got to do something. I think I got retrenched from an advertising job.
Right.
I just bought this little MX-5 convertible, and if you have Mazda MX-5, so it was a flashy little thing.
Yep,
I didn't have a ponytail, but I was working in an advertising agency and still trying to play music, and I think she just kind of said, you know, this is rubbish. You got to do something. You're going to, you know, how are you going to make money?
Yeah.
And luckily I finished university and did all those things, but I didn't really have any interest in doing anything other than writing little ditties. And
but you had what a lot of people would say was a good job, right?
Yeah, in advertising.
Yeah.
I only had one job ever.
Interesting that she was encouraging you to step away from it.
No, I got retrenched.
And what does retrenched mean?
Retrenched means fired, like finished.
Like redundant.
Redundant.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
And that was left me just sitting there. The guy gave me $1,000 and said, thanks so much.
$1,000. Nice.
Yeah, that's nice. Because in advertising, it's kind of like the last in, first out. When you lose an account, it's kind of severe. And so I never worked. That was my first and last job.
Interesting. Yeah.
And I just knew sitting there with this, with the repayments of this car and this, you know, girlfriend who was, you know, pretty high maintenance, that, yeah, I can't go through this again.
Yeah.
And maybe music isn't for me, and maybe I'm painting a bad picture of my parents, but maybe they were right. You just, you know, this is a hobby,
right?
And you just get on with the stuff that's going to make some money.
I don't think you're painting a bad picture of your parents. I think it's normal for parents to be concerned about their kids' welfare, and they want the best for you.
I agree.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. I just mean like more so that the idea that obviously I've continue to do what I do and make music, so they must have had something that was supportive to allow me to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're sitting there, you've been made redundant or retrenched. Is that an Aussie term, is it?
I don't know. I feel like it's an international business term.
Oh, yeah? Oh, thanks.
Retrenched. Danny's writing
just put
it down.
Put that in my pocket, yeah.
It's a good word to have. You never want to experience it, but it's a good word to have.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, don't get retrenched, man. But so write a song about it.
So you're sitting there in this moment. What do you do next? What's the first step? To set yourself up to make a living.
I decided I was a pretty good copywriter.
Right.
Which is like, you know, writing ads.
Yeah.
I could write that kind of wank sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing it, setting up a freelance kind of, you know, business in that sense.
So at this point it's just words.
It's just words.
Yeah.
But I found that every single brief that I was getting for advertising, I'd always have a musical solution for it.
Right.
It felt a lot easier than actual words.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there'd be like a supermarket or a new shampoo, and I just knew how to either put a well-known song into it and it would fit, or I could easily hear the hook and hear how I wanted to kind of turn the music into the ad.
Yeah.
And people were getting sort of sick of that response all the time because it felt like I was just pushing my own agenda.
Right.
But I really felt that on a medium like television and radio, music just cuts through. You know?
At this point, were you thinking in the terms of jingles, or were you thinking broader or vaguer?
Yeah, look, I really did grow up with jingles. My dad, all our car trips to, you know, we drove everywhere from Melbourne to Queensland, you know, big road trips for summers and holidays, and always had artists like, you know, Rolf Harris and quirky artists that stayed in my head about the ditty. I don't know if you call them ditties but they're, you know, they're just simple things with simple hooks that cut through.
Right.
And especially growing up as a kid in the 70s and 80s, jingles were the big, you know, the big thing. And we had these guys in Australia called the Mojo,
Okay.
M-O-J-O.
Yeah.
Morrison Johnson, I think they were, but they wrote every single jingle.
Really?
Yeah. And you could just tell it. It warmed your heart. It made you feel patriotic. It just...
But most of us hear these things and, you know, they get stuck in our head or whatever, but we don't really think too much about it. Obviously, you focused
on
them.
Did.
You tuned into them.
No, I thought they were the soundtracks to everything.
Right.
Know? Whether they were a washing machine or a beer, I just kind of love them.
I think you're right. I mean, like, you know, when you hear a TV ad from when you were a kid.
Yeah,
it takes nostalgic. You right back straight away.
Oh, yeah. You know, I can... That's what I mean. I walk through a supermarket aisle and it's like turning the dial of a radio for me. Every brand's got a sound.
Right.
And I still feel that some of my purchase decisions are based on feeling nostalgic and connected to a brand. So it's kind of like songs. You know how we were talking before about why these kind of cover concepts work and people feel so connected to hearing their old favorite songs?
Yep.
It's the same thing. You know, when I'm writing a jingle now, I really think about that stuff and try to connect the dots so that I'm writing a song essentially that's going to have an emotion. And, you know, it's treated like it might be 30 seconds, but it's like writing a 3-minute song.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on. And I think a lot of the time we connect with music based on the emotion attached to it or the feeling around it, which is why in the old music industry, they'd be releasing songs at certain times of the year to try and get the summer hit or whatever.
Yeah, totally.
If you just hear a song cold, it's really hard to like it, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, or at least you don't like it, you don't not like it, but you're just neutral.
No, that's it.
But it's when it hits you in a certain way, on a certain angle, in a certain moment. And that's harder to do even with pop music these days, isn't
it? Really hard.
Yeah.
You've got the added benefit with ad music because you're pretty sure that once the client buys it, it's going to be on high rotation. So it's like having a hit.
Yeah.
It's on rotation.
Exactly.
So it's got every chance to stand out and cut through.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's the buzz, you know. I've only really come to really appreciate that when I do hear it on radio, and now we obviously, you know, we've got hundreds of jingles on air. I feel really excited about it.
But how did you get the work in the first place? Because it's a great concept, but how do you actually bang doors down? And
yeah, I did. I knocked on a lot of doors. I went around with a crappy little reel.
Mm-hmm.
And a few good people gave me a few good opportunities.
Right.
And
a lot of rejections on the way.
Yeah, a lot of rejections. Yep. And I think my first jingle was for the Army, the Australian Army.
Oh.
My first big breakthrough.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, this is the edge, really deep. This is the edge. I mean, this kept going, big U2 kind of drumming.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Chris, was part of that, and he kind of set that up. And I remember, you know, we wrote this thing on a tape recorder and went to this big advertising agency that he had a contact with, and I'd never had anything to do with that world. And the guy said, yep, we like it, and he told us the amount. And we were just like, oh, shit.
It was a good amount?
Yeah, bloody great amount.
Right.
This is like... for kids.
Was it one of those situations where he was like, was that okay with you? And you were like,
yeah, we'll speak to our lawyers.
We'll get back to you.
I had no idea. You could have put anything in front of me. You could have just said, we're going to give $10. And,
cheeseburger.
Oh, yeah. Cheeseburger. I'll sign that. So I was, you know, really blown away by that. And that one jingle fortuitously opened up so many doors.
Because
suddenly we had a big national client.
Yeah. You had validation.
Total validation. I could cockily go in and say, yeah, we've done the Army. It was apparently the lowest uptake of recruits for that year, but you know, that's okay. I take pride in that.
Right.
Because, you know, I'm not really a war kind of, you know.
Yeah, you contributed to peace.
Contributed to peace. Obviously, people heard it and that year, like, fuck that.
I'm
not joining that. It's music shit. The edge. What are they fucking talking about? What edge? You just get shot and shit.
So you did it. You did us a favor. That's brilliant. Yeah.
So that was all I could do, people. Yeah. Australians listening, it was all I could do to help the war.
You've done your part. You probably saved lives.
Yeah, I was. I was really the peacenik, you know, behind it. It was my give peace a chance. So that was really cool, and that really opened up doors. And then I suddenly had a real... that people trusted you once you got one or two big names on there. And, yeah, I still have fond memories about that. And, look, business is – I didn't grow up in a business family. I had to teach myself this whole world.
Right.
Because my parents all worked. Dad worked for the – he was an aeronautical engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Mum was a school teacher. So they both had jobs with government kind of agencies. It was set up.
Salaries.
And in that era, you know, even when you stop working, you're set up and doing things.
Yep.
So, you know, not that it was conservative, but that was their – that was their frame of reference.
So it was a motivation to upskill in business when you started your business? Was it a means to an end sort of thing?
Yeah, it was. It was. I really felt this need that every success is yours and every failure is yours. Right. That's still the stuff that excites me and scares me at the same time. You know, it's
healthy space.
Yeah, it is. It is healthy. But, you know, we were able to grow it. We still do exactly what we were doing. It's been 13 years now since I really kind of took myself seriously doing it. Mm-hmm. And it's taken 13 years to really kind of be really proud of what I do and talk about it in the same context of my own music.
Yeah, it was interesting because when we were talking about doing this podcast and I was saying how the perception of the professional musician is a lot more glamorous and exciting, but the reality is we're all tutors and writing jingles. And
as my wife says, every poet has a day job.
Exactly. You know? Yeah. That's exactly right. We're all playing in covers bands and we're doing stuff that doesn't seem very impressive. And I said sometimes we're embarrassed about that sort of stuff. And you made some comment to the effect of sometimes you're embarrassed about the jingles. Yeah. Which is actually amazing because it's a huge success and it's something a lot of people would envy. But how do you, you're not really feeling that embarrassment against what someone else thinks. You're feeling it against what you expected of yourself when you were young.
Possibly. Yeah. And I also have never been one of those people who came running from an exam saying, I've nailed that.
Right.
There were kids who did that and they did nail it.
Yeah.
But I was one of the space in the buffer zone that when I did fail or I did succeed, at least it could go either way.
Right.
And I think I live like that now. If you ask me how was that, I'm never going to go, oh, my God, we fucking killed it and we did it. I sort of sit comfortably in the...
Are you trying to defend your self-deprecating nature by saying that it's somehow an artistic strategy?
Could possibly be dressed up as that.
Yeah.
Maybe it
is. I think the other word for that is bullshit.
Bullshit. I haven't quite worked that out, but I just know that I feel more comfortable in sort of going, I don't know, didn't like this, did I? Maybe it's a Jewish thing, I don't know, it's a cultural thing.
But isn't it important to learn to pat yourself on the back?
Man, it would be.
I mean, you've established a successful company that produces music that gets lots of play and makes you money.
Yes.
And you're raising your family through that.
Yes.
Isn't that something to be proud of?
It really is. And if I was you, I'd slap me in the face across the mic. It's a bit too far, but he probably... Yeah. He looked like he was going to lurch. Duncan might do it for my right. Yeah. You know what, man? Someone also pointed out that it's always you can look in on other things of other people doing things and everything looks more exciting.
That's
right. And I'm just always too scared to say this is amazing and do it because I always maybe even feel bad for people that aren't.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's right.
I just kind of feel and I don't want to jinx it.
So I'm still not clear, though, on why you got out of music.
Well, the band kind of dissolved. I had never stopped writing songs.
Right.
I've got a notepad filled with songs for the last, 15 years.
Yeah.
But I think it just, work takes over, and...
Also, it just sort of fell to the side.
It fell to the side and kids take over and I was kind of, I needed a kick.
Gotcha.
I needed a push. We all do, I think.
Yeah.
Duncan's been really good pushing me and in times when I haven't been able to organise something, he'll just, we're doing this and that was the show and that was the last show we did as a full band. You know, it's really hopeless. I'm hopeless. I really am hopeless.
Right.
And if I didn't have people around who believed in me, I don't think I would do much.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. So what gave you the push to start it again? What got
that Neil Finn experience.
Oh, right.
Totally validated me. Huh. Totally made me go, fuck, well, would he sing on a song of someone that he doesn't like?
Yeah.
I doubt it.
Yeah.
So maybe my songs are good.
Because even though you haven't released it yet, you are allowed to, right? It's not like it's...
I'm allowed, no, of course. No, yeah. Totally. Was just an experience and that was something we did. The truth of the matter is that same song, when I went to Nashville, the guys kind of really fell in love with it again.
Yeah.
And even though I thought it was totally, that was definitive. Where do you go from having your absolute hero on your track singing harmonies?
Yeah.
You can hear the knife stabbing into my own hurry-curry kind of thing as it's happening. It's probably me yelling or, salivating or something as it's happening. But where do you go from there? So I think when I got to Nashville, they just re-recorded it. And it was kind of sad for me in a little bit because I was kind of like, they didn't quite understand the gravity of Crowded House to me.
Yeah.
Maybe now with Fleetwood Mac and understanding who Neil Finn is there in that context, maybe they would have. It wasn't that they didn't like it. They just heard something different.
Did you have the stems? Like, was there ever a conversation about lifting his BVs and putting them in?
No. It was a totally different feel.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was a really different feel. They really gave it the Nashville feel, sound there. And look, in some ways it opened a lot of doors in the new way. I'm really proud of the new EP that we did.
Yeah.
I'm proud of the new version. And I'm really proud that, you know, I've got a version with someone that I admire, truly, honest, who gave me the validation to kind of keep going.
But also the Nashville version of the song doesn't mean the other song can't come out.
No, no, totally.
Yeah. These days all bets are off, right? You can do whatever you want.
Totally. Yeah. And look, the same thing is with the song Hinges that we did.
Yeah.
That turned into Turn This Love Around, which got, got onto the Billboard charts.
Oh, right.
And I got to kind of, the guy who I co-wrote in Nashville with is a guy called Frank Myers. Mm-hmm. Who's he won a Grammy for that song, I Swear by the Moon. It's not that that's the style of music, but he's you know, great guys.
Yeah,
walls filled with gold records. So you're sort of sitting there with this guy. I really trust in producers. I really believe in the role of a producer. And so I was kind of open to, if I'm here, let's just go with it. If you feel there's a better song in something, who am I? I'm nobody from nowhere.
Right.
Let's do this.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've got the Neil Finn versions. I've got a Change song. Please Don't Cry hasn't changed one bit.
Yeah.
In terms of words, and I'd love the industry to know that, you know, the Neil Finn versions exist, and love to know what they think. Sure, maybe back of his mind, if he remembers even who I am, it would be great for him to know that it actually did something too.
Maybe we should make a video for it. Put it up.
Yeah, that would be really cool.
Yeah. So you came back from.
Oh, we did do.
No. You just remembered you made a video?
No.
No?
We did do a video for the Neil Finn version.
Right.
And then I came back because things just take so long in my life.
Yeah.
That the guys had aged and got, you know, with it. And the film clip is the same film clip, but we hadn't changed tempo with the Nashville version.
Right.
So it all just slotted in.
Fit together.
Yeah. I think I even did write to Neil and say, we're shooting this clip. Are you in Melbourne? Would you like to come?
Yeah.
Just thinking that we're mates.
No reply?
Well, no, there was a reply. Oh, very courteous. No, I'm sorry, I'm not there. And
He probably would have done it too.
I reckon he would have.
Yeah.
He's so generous with his time. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah.
Well, how long ago were you in recording in Nashville?
That was 2 years ago.
Okay. And so what's happening since then?
Since then,
so you made
songs,
the EP.
Made the EP. Yep. And since then, we've released 3 singles from it.
Yep.
And each of them have garnered really great radio support in Australia.
Yep.
And the US.
Right.
And that second single, Turn This Love Around, you know, it got into the US Billboard charts for 6 weeks, top 30.
Fantastic.
Seeing your name up there with big artists, you know, daily, I just couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
So it connected somehow. I didn't quite feel it was strong enough for me to go over there and start exploiting that.
Yeah.
But it's
big
certainly...
Big country to take on.
Big country to take on.
Yep.
And Larry's certainly there working so hard, but without a label, it's really hard.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing this independently and it's really hard.
Right, yeah. So why were you accused of murder?
Oh, that's right in there. Well, yeah, that's the murder story. All right, you got a whiskey? So I was in my 20s, going back, and I had a friend of mine, Mitch, who just got me in lots of trouble all the time. He's just one of those friends.
Yeah.
And he's now a pilot, so he's serious and has a real, you know. He grew up.
Yeah, bastard.
But we went to a place, a rural town called Bendigo in Victoria, and our job was basically to refill those lolly boxes on the shop counters, you know, you've got to be honest and put your money in and you take your caramels or your marshmallows or your chocolate bullets or whatever it is. So it was a pretty easy job. You know, we got stoned and we were just these kids just running around town having fun, flirting with everyone and just, you know, just having an absolute ball. And we walked into an antique store and the lollies were behind the counter. So my handprints are all over this counter trying to lean over to get it. And I could see something happening in the top right corner.
Yeah.
And... But I could see shadows or just someone moving and making noise. So I'm like banging and knocking and, you know, I don't know where Mitch is. Maybe he was outside or something. So we left and obviously I'm on the camera coming out and fingerprints are everywhere. And it wasn't, you know, little did we know that at that moment a woman was being murdered.
What, in the back of the store or something? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She must, who knows? I just can't believe, you know, a lot went through my head later of what I could have done or... Should have done or...
How old are you again?
Would have been 21, 22.
Okay. Yeah.
Yep. So we left, went home and next thing...
So you obviously had no idea at the
time.
Idea.
Just left. No idea. Left, went home. And we were called in and pretty soon it was very easy to make a connection with, does anyone have any witnesses of suspects there and fingerprints and all that kind of crap. It got really scary because they started saying, well, Mitch told us that you did it. You know, and I'm like, oh, fuck, this is real. Like, did he do it? Like, where was he? Where's my friend who I've grown up with? Did shit.
They're just trying it on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pushing you. And it was really scary for my parents. It was a really freaky time. What made it worse is that a month earlier I had not declared a flick knife that I bought from Poland on a trip that couldn't even get through a tissue box. It was such crap.
Right.
But I just loved the novelty of having, you remember the ones with combs?
No.
Didn't you guys have that here?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Flick combs?
Yeah,
and it was just cool. Yeah. You were Grease Lightning or whatever it was. Right, yeah. This was a real knife, but it was such crap. Yeah. I just didn't declare it, and I must have looked seedy or something, and they searched me, and it was on my record. So I'm thinking knife, murder, rap. This is In the Name of the Father. Take two. I'm gone. The community wants an answer, and I'm in prison. You know. And, yeah, that was a pretty scary time. They found the guy pretty quickly, and he was someone who'd, you know, unfortunately stalked her, and, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be terrifying. Oh, I've always been, that's always been a fear of mine, to be accused of something I didn't do.
Oh, you man.
Know, to do something bad and to have a catch up with you would be a different problem.
Yeah.
But to someone to be, like, especially if you have to go to court and you're innocent. God.
But also, and now how public things are, you imagine just the shaming, the social media.
You'd lose everything even if you're innocent.
No, and all these people that finally get out, I kind of think regardless of the millions they get in compensation.
If I...
How do you even live in prison and trust the world knowing that you have really not done what you've been told you've done?
That's right.
Yeah.
That's You'd crazy. Lose faith in the whole thing.
So it didn't
you?
Happen. Yeah. And I was able to, you know, become a jingle writer.
and then promote peace by fucking up the armies.
Butchers are my favorite clients, you know, just meat industry and, you know, I'm scarred. Every song sounds like Nick Cave.
Yeah. Well, I'm keen to hear some of these jingles. I'm also keen to hear one of your songs, but I'm keen to hear the jingles first, and I'm pretty sure I'm safe in saying that the listeners are pretty excited about hearing your jingles.
Yeah, well, that's pretty cool. I could do a tour. It would last about 8 minutes, back-to-back songs.
Yeah, you got a best of in your head?
I think so.
What's the one that you've pissed off most of Australia with, the 1-3 Cabs?
Yeah, 1-3 Cabs is the main national kind of taxi body.
Could you hear that? All of our Australian listeners just went, that motherfucker! It's that motherfucker!
It's that guy.
Yeah.
We're going to check outside when we leave, because people know address, but it's kind of like every time, everywhere, 1-3 Cabs will get you there. It's that important whistle at the end.
That's the hook. Yeah,
and that jingle's been great. Chemist Warehouse is a brand that's I think new to New Zealand,
right?
And we've certainly been part of all their sort of advertising.
Yep.
Chemist Warehouse, why pay cha-ching more? It's the cha-ching again. It's all those little mnemonics and little sonic things that you put in.
You've got a few with like tapping hands, right? I don't know if that'll get on the mic.
Which ones have we got tapping hands? There must be some. We've used tapping
hands.
You're
talking about them in the van.
Oh, yeah. Well, talking about how that genre of, you know, ukulele and whistles, there's a real zeitgeist at the moment of that kind of innocence, kind of simple music, which is hard to write.
Yeah.
But it connects for a whole range of those kind of serious brands because it allows them to sound like, yeah, we're easy, man. You just bank with us and read the fine print. But, you know, but on the top, it's all
it's kind of kids music.
Kids music,
like the Wiggles.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it's all about how you phrase things and how you connect with people through these little ditties, essentially.
I feel like saying that it's like kids' music is minimizing it a bit, you know, like you were saying earlier, you've got to get that emotional connection.
Yeah.
Do you get the balance wrong sometimes and do you go a little too deep into the emotion and think, oh, that's a bit far?
Yeah, totally.
You know, less minor chords.
Less minor chords. You can't use minor chords. I mean, because you've essentially got 5 seconds to cut through.
Tell a story.
Yeah. And it
makes it more impressive in a way. I mean, if you're writing a 25-minute prog piece, that's fucking easy. Just dribble on,
a couple of solos, drum solos, you know, you can do anything.
But to get the plot art to work over 5 seconds is fucking hard.
And to write the chorus that's going to make people stand up and remember it so that when they're walking through the shopping aisle, they kind of go, oh yeah, Huggies nappies, definitely.
Yeah.
And that's why licensing well-known songs has its place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can understand why ad agencies would just buy into, you know, the latest track because it helps to cut through and people kind of can quickly associate an emotion with a brand.
Right.
But the danger with that is that, you know, there's no exclusivity. Another brand can use the same track.
Yeah.
So, you know, we would always push for something bespoke and always something new, you know.
Have you ever had to write a jingle for a product you didn't believe in or you were against in some way?
Yeah. There was a gambling ad that I was really greyhound racing, something like that, which I just don't connect with. Mm. And I felt really bad for the way people's lives have been changed by that sort of stuff. So
but you did it.
We did it. Luckily, it didn't go through.
Oh, okay, right.
I was removed from that. Yeah. There was also one ad of this product where it was a pill that gave you a tan.
Oh.
And I just had my feelings without research.
Sound right, eh?
People, all the research I'd read showed that people just had these orange feet. The whole the pill actually was so dangerous, it just sunk down your body and you just had this tanned, extra ultra tanned Oompa Loompa style orange feet.
They got the spread wrong.
I
wonder if you take more of the pills, you sort of slowly go up your legs.
Well,
you know,
this sounds, I mentioned Oompa Loompa, but it's kind of like, you know, it still needs work, you know, when she's, we haven't quite got to that. It always goes wrong at the blueberries.
Imagine if there was a need for orange feet. It'd be a killer.
These guys would have scored big time, but they wanted a jingle in a weird way, and it would be orange feet. Orange feet.
Wasn't that how Viagra came around? Weren't they trying to do something else? And they're like, everyone keeps getting boners.
They just keep getting, very excited.
But then again, there's a problem with people not getting boners.
So that's it.
A plus B, you know?
Necessity is all the, what is it? Invention is the,
something about necessity. I know what you mean.
Something with necessity.
That one.
So we just didn't do it. I just sort of said, I just didn't feel good about it and turned it down. But look, largely we'll do anything.
Yeah.
Because why shouldn't every brand have a piece of music? And if people are going to, you know, pay for it, I'm in for it.
Yeah, I think there's so many areas in the music industry where there's that kind of wrestle, isn't there, with morality and how you feel, whether you feel connected to something.
Yeah.
But it is a job, you know, and you write whatever you want to write when it's your music.
Yeah.
But when it's a job, it's a job.
Yeah, totally. I totally have made that distinction and take it seriously. And I love walking into the studio knowing that this is everything I've built.
Yep.
And again, every success is mine, and the day starts, and I'm excited for something that didn't exist. That's the whole beauty of working in the industry I'm in, is that something didn't exist one day and it does the next day, and it can potentially stay on for the next generation.
Right. You know? Exactly.
And we have got jingles now because we've been doing it for that long that it's been on for a decade.
Yeah.
And they're part of the brands, and it makes me happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're talking, what was our conversation yesterday in the van right up north? We were talking about trying to think of artists that were game changers. And you made the argument, or your friend made the argument, that there hasn't been an artist since Nirvana that's been an absolute cultural game change. And I still can't think of one.
No.
Yeah.
No, we got close with Prodigy for that genre.
I don't know if I was on board with that idea.
No,
I think
they were
popular. But.
And it wasn't a whole album's worth, maybe, definitely. There are moments, definitely, of bands we thought of. But so.
I mean, going back, there are loads of them, you know, back in the 60s and so on.
And then you rightly pointed out that 1-3 Cabs was my defining moment.
That's your game changer.
And it's hard to accept. How do I take that?
Well, as I pointed out to you, you exist in that space at the end of the night when someone's been on a night out.
Yeah.
When they're in between, when they're in puking. Between coming and puking.
And that is a space that I feel, I'm going to get that on a t-shirt, you know, Danny.
In between coming and puking, and they think of your
where
jingle.
I feel good.
How are we going to get home? I think I'm going to puke, but I really want to come, you know.
And you're
1-3 Cavs.
You're asking where Duncan's tattoo fits in.
Right.
D fits in between C and P, so we're fine. We'll do the alphabet.
It's going to work out.
Yeah.
All right, well, what song are you going to play us?
I think we're going to do... Designed to Love You. This is a new song. I haven't recorded it yet, but it's really a song I really enjoy singing. I had this whole group of friends where the wives kind of just left them.
Oh, really?
They just kind of exploded the whole relationship.
Interesting.
And I was kind of like, well, what is this all built on? What did you kind of expect?
Yeah.
What did you think was going to happen?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard work being in something, being in a relationship.
Long term.
Yeah, long term. And so this song's all about that, and, you know, it kind of twists into other ways, and there's no jingles in it.
Cool. Yeah. It's all yours. So this is an exclusive.
Yeah, this is Designed to Love You.
All right.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Do you remember?
cross is always looking for a line. Give me a wink to let me know that you're fine.
I'm definitely a fan now of Michael Burrows and his lap steel player. That was a really nice touch, man. Well done.
Isn't it great hearing a lap steel? Lap steel's cool, right?
It's awesome. I know, right? When was the last time you heard one of those?
Well, yeah. all the time because of the music I listen to. but
okay, well, that was more me asking myself that question out loud then, I guess.
But having him sitting right here in the room playing it, like that was literally right in my little studio, and it was. What a magic moment. It's great.
Very cool. Yeah.
So thanks, Michael, for being on the show.
Thanks, Michael. And who was the lap steel player?
His name is Duncan Schmoll, and he's a great guitar player too. Very cool.
Awesome.
Thanks to all the listeners, and thanks to the sponsors. Thanks to everyone who helps us make this happen. And we'll see you on the next one.
Excellent. Cheers.
See ya.
Find what we're doing useful and you like this podcast, please do like, share and subscribe and give us a review on iTunes.